Welcome to the Off the Charts Football Podcast. I'm Matt Manicharian, former NFL scout and currently of Sports Info Solutions, joined by Aaron Schatz, the godfather of football analytics and the founder of Football Outsiders. As always, our producer, Justin Stein, is with us, and we are here to break down the NFL draft. We are now a week removed. Aaron, now that we've had a week to decompress, any major takeaways before we kind of get into some of the breakdowns?
Well, I give them credit for having the whole thing go smoothly, first of all. I mean, the fact is we were all worried about some kind of technical issue, and there were no technical issues. We managed to take 255 players, and it doesn't sound like any team screwed anything up. So,
well, many teams might have screwed things up.
Well, I mean, technically. They didn't forget to call in or miss a trade because they didn't call it in or anything like that. I mean, yes, there's certainly some drafts that we can talk about that some of which were universally panned, Green Bay, but now we've had a week to sort of decompress and look at the picks that may have seemed questionable on draft night. Now you sort of understand, I think. We've talked a little bit about the ideas behind them, such as Philadelphia taking Jalen Hurts in the second round, some of what Green Bay did. We've had a chance to look at grades. Football Outsiders ran our 17th annual draft report card of report cards, where we compile all the report cards and look at what the consensus is. And so we know what teams people feel did well or did badly. Although who knows how much that means. The Dallas Cowboys had the highest consensus GPA of any draft since the 2015 Jacksonville Jaguars. This sounds impressive until you realize the players that the Jaguars drafted in 2015 were highlighted by Dante Fowler, TJ Yeldon, and AJ Cann. So that high consensus draft grade they got that year wasn't necessarily borne out by how good those players were in the NFL.
I love it. So very similar to what we were talking about before the draft, the kind of expected draft position based on the mocks. This is a meta-analysis of the grades for whatever that's worth. So let's talk about that. Let's get right into the Football Outsiders NFL draft report cards. Who had the number one draft this year? You said it was the Cowboys, rather.
It was the Dallas Cowboys. And I think that the Cowboys, I'm going to guess, are pretty high in how much their draft agreed with the rookie handbook also. I mean, they just got a lot of players later than anybody expected them to go. The biggest one being CeeDee Lamb at 17, who we had as the number one receiver. You guys had it number two, but I think both of us would have expected to go before 17th overall, but then also cornerback Trevon Diggs lasting till the middle of the second round, I think was also more than what anybody's consensus would have expected before the draft.
Yeah, so we kind of broke things down in two different ways here over the week. So Nate Cooper and John Todd, the two lead scouts at SIS, they looked at in terms of agreement with the rookie handbook grades. And yes, by that metric, the Cowboys were fourth on our list behind the Browns, Bengals, and Cardinals. So the fourth most agreement there, really liked what they did compared to what we thought. In terms of what Alex Fingerman looked at, which was more of a total points-based metric. He made this interesting visualization also on the Sports Info Solutions blog that looked at what percentage of your needs were filled versus how much value you accumulated. And actually, on both of those, by a total points standpoint, the Cowboys came out kind of right in the middle. They're packed in the middle of the chart. They're kind of buried, so you can barely even see them. But it's interesting when you look at it in terms of kind of the metrics and kind of looking at it purely in terms of total points, which is going to have different things, you know, depending on what positions you draft, there are going to be different things that go on there. But in terms of the grades, there's a lot of agreement.
It suggests that they drafted more players who were thought of to have more future value than they did 2019 college value.
Yes. And I think that's fair. Looking back also past CeeDee Lamb for them, who had the hilarious moment that is captured on the Football Outsiders article with his girlfriend grabbing the cell phone, the day two picks, Trevon Diggs and Neville Gallimore are also both people that I think are kind of universally liked, and you see how those guys will fit in. Trevon Diggs had some injury issues over his time at Alabama, but in terms of physical ability, we absolutely loved him. And Neville Gallimore is a guy that will bring some interesting kind of interior pass rush to the Cowboys. So both really nice picks there.
Another team that people really liked what they did was the Minnesota Vikings, and they had the lowest standard deviation, which means not only did people like what they did, but everybody liked what they did. The lowest grade they got in our summary of grades was B+. Now, they actually came in a bit lower in the compared to the rookie handbook, although part of that might be because they took so many players. They took 15 that, you know, it was natural that some of those 15 were going to be not as ranked as highly by the rookie handbook.
Right. So they made the big trade. They picked up all of those picks, and they ended up accumulating the most value in terms of total points. And no surprise there, like you're talking about, when you draft 15 players, you're going to do that. They also stood out. They were number 3 in terms of the percentage of needs filled. So a lot of value and a lot of need filling by them when you looked at Alex's methodology there. Going back to Coop and John Todd and their breakdown, yeah, they're looking in terms of the average grade. So that did pull the Vikings down a little bit when you draft 15 people. Still, I'm always in favor of it. Anytime that you can just pick up that many slots, these are all just cheap contract players that have the potential to create value. If 10 of them make your team, you're doing outstanding.
Well, I mean, their big losses this offseason were Stephon Diggs at wide receiver and then like half their cornerbacks. And so the top picks they took were Justin Jefferson at wide receiver and two cornerbacks, Cam Dantzler and Jeff Gladney. I mean, clearly they went straight for picking holes, but they didn't do that by reaching. They didn't reach for guys that people thought were going to go later. So
when you look at things analytically, and this is why it's no surprise to see how they work out in Alex's rankings, whenever you have the ability to accumulate draft picks, you're just giving yourself more shots at the dartboard and more chances to hit bullseyes as a result. You look at some players that are on the Vikings right now. We've talked at length, I think, about how what's his name at safety was an undrafted free agent,
Anthony Harris.
And then looking at the receiver position itself, it wasn't like Stephon Diggs was a high draft pick. I think he came in the 5th round.
Yep.
So I mean, this is a team that's found players late and undrafted time and time again. So I think you're accumulating value.
It's interesting. There's a number of teams here where there's a difference between how their picks graded in the rookie handbook and where they fall on that needs filled versus total points in 2019 rubric. And another one is the team that had the 3rd highest average GPA from our draft graders, and that is the Arizona Cardinals, who come out really high in draft team grades using the rookie handbook. But in that rubric, they didn't fill a lot of needs. They mostly took players based on best player available rather than filling needs. I mean, with the clearest example of that being Isaiah Simmons. If Isaiah Simmons, you know, I think everybody would have agreed that taking him at number 8 overall is fantastic. He's so talented, you just find a place to put him in your defense. But they already kind of have like 2 or 3 off-ball linebackers. And at least based on what they've said publicly, that's how they're going to use him. Although I don't believe it. I believe that they're going to move him around as much as is possible, given that we don't know how long training camp and playbook installation is going to be due to COVID-19. But you don't announce we're going to move Isaiah Simmons around. You announce we're always going to play him here, and then you surprise your opponents by moving him around, right? So, like, I don't believe Arizona when they say we're only using him at inside linebacker.
So when I look at the Cardinals draft pick, I think you're absolutely right. And they did a pretty good job finishing 50th percentile in value when you look at only having 6 picks and not having a 2nd-round pick. So it's the players that they did have that I think they did well on. Isaiah Simmons at the top, and then Josh Jones lasting until the 3rd round. That surprised me. He was somebody that I thought, based on his performance at the Senior Bowl, he was going to rocket up the charts. Maybe some injury concerns there. He's a little bit of a kind of lower upside type player. So I understand, but I think that's pretty good value. And I think he's a nice fit in their offense. So you see why he turned out well in terms of the grades and also in terms of compared to the rookie handbook, he was also number 3.
And then the team that you guys have as best filling needs, and I absolutely agree with this, is the team that's number 4 in average GPA. And that's the Baltimore Ravens, because, you know, they went into the week with LJ Fort and who the heck knows as their projected starting inside linebackers. And they come out of it with Patrick Queen to fill that role, probably playing next to Fort, which is fantastic. And then Malik Harrison as more of a pass rusher. And then Justin Madubuike to fill the role that was Michael Pierce, where Michael Pierce left. And J.K. Dobbins, I guess, you know, I'm not a fan of taking running backs in the second round, especially when you kind of have that position filled already. But, you know, he is a talented player. So they get also really good grades.
Yeah, it's easy to accumulate a lot of value and to fill a lot of needs when you have five picks in the first 2 days, which they did. The Patrick Queen pick, I think everybody loves that. He fell right into their lap. Somebody that graded out really well, good in terms of total points. I think you hit on it with J.K. Dobbins. Whether we can argue all day about the value of drafting running backs, this is late in the second round, so it's not something that I'm philosophically opposed to. Also, you're going to want to build your team around first contract running backs more often than not, just because you really don't want to give them a second contract if you can avoid it. But filling that Mark Ingram role and complimenting him and then taking over, it's just so easy to see how Dobbins fits so well with that Lamar Jackson backfield.
Yeah, I mean, they've got Ingram for two more years, but then maybe, you know, if Dobbins looks good as a rookie, they don't keep Ingram for the third year, and then they've got three years of Dobbins at a really low rate. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I'd have to look up the Ingram contract, but I think, you know, we're always gonna find ways to argue against investing any sort of value on running backs. But as far as if you're going to do it, the pick seems to make a lot of sense there. And then, yeah, I think you're right when you talk about how Madubuike fits in, how DuVernay fits in with their receiver group, kind of the polar opposite of a Marquise Brown. And Malik Harrison has a good chance of playing for them kind of early and often too. So nice draft there for the Ravens. And you see, yeah, really when you look at it in terms of not only being filling the most needs, they were also tied with the Eagles in terms of being fourth for value, which is an interesting segue, because I want to talk about the Eagles and I want to talk about an interesting choice that they made. The Eagles taking Jalen Hurts, of course, in the second round. What was your takeaway on that move?
My initial takeaway was a colossal amount of head scratching. The more I thought about it, and then the more that I read some of the things that people wrote about it, I came to sort of understand it. I think that if you understand that pick as they wanted their own Taysom Hill, it looks terrible. Part of the beauty of Taysom Hill is that they picked him up as an undrafted free agent and they figured out a way to use him in a lot of different ways, but their offense is not built around him. You don't take a gadget player like that in the second round. If you look at it through the lens of it is just good to fill your roster with as many high upside quarterbacks as possible, I think the pick makes a lot more sense. Now, the idea behind that is if Wentz somehow stagnates or gets injured, that they have Hurts to put in and that Hurts comes with a high upside. And I think we can both agree on that, right? Based on both his performance last year, total points, your scouting on him, what Cube said, we have Hurts as a really high upside play, right? Obviously, you don't know how much of his great performance last year was just being in the Oklahoma offense, but that just means he's high upside. Like, that means he's not guaranteed high, but he's high upside. I guess the idea is, you know, there's a chance that Hurts could be an above average starting quarterback in the NFL if it turns out that Wentz, in the long run, is not an above average quarterback. My problem is, how do you tell, right? Like, if he's not going to get playing time, then you're stuck going on preseason games and reports out of camp. I mean, you know, it throws back to Garoppolo. Like, imagine if the Patriots had taken Garoppolo in the second round, not thinking that Brady might decline or retire, right? Imagine they took Garoppolo in the second round when Brady was 30. And imagine then that Brady doesn't get suspended. So Garoppolo never gets to start three games in the regular season. So now they're trying to trade this guy 3 or 4 years in, and nobody knows anything about him any more than they knew on draft day. Why would you feel you'd get a higher pick for him? Like, how would you know that you should turn the offense over to him? How would you know that you'd get a higher pick for him? So I think this reminds me a little bit of Denver taking Tommy Maddox when John Elway was still like in his prime. And they never figured out quite what to do with Tommy Maddox. And he ended up selling insurance until the XFL. So I feel it's a very complicated pick.
very complicated pick. There are a lot of layers to it that I think you're bringing out. I want to separate out like the player from the team, even though there's some, those are obviously related on a certain way. I don't love Jalen Hurts. I don't really believe in his ability to become a starting level quarterback. I don't think he'd be worthy of a second day pick in terms of.
Oh, so you disagree with sort of the stats based type metrics on him on that.
I really do. I think that playing in the Oklahoma offense, I think really helps him. I think that inflates a lot of things about what he was able to accomplish. Now, gone back and I've looked at the film, and it's easy to remember what he was at Alabama and have that really kind of cloud your vision on him. But then at the same time, it's also easy to watch him at Oklahoma and have a sort of recency bias when you've seen how this guy looks in a different system. So I think you've got to take those both into account. And at the end of the day, I think he has a chance. I like him as a backup quarterback. I just don't like taking a backup quarterback on day two. Which I think is kind of your point. Interesting you brought up Tommy Maddox, because I thought back to the Kirk Cousins pick when you're bringing in RG3, and that's your guy, obviously, but they kind of also brought in Kirk Cousins at the same time. But I think he was like the fourth round pick, not a second round pick. The thing about Hurts that makes him different goes back to what you said before about Taysom Hill. And Taysom Hill, much more valuable than Jalen Hurts could ever be, because Taysom Hill, they got him for nothing. And that's by definition not what they spent on Jalen Hurts. They spent a lot on him. So it's hard for it to end up being – it can't end up that positively, even if he works out to be the player that Taysom Hill is, whatever that is, by the way. But I do think if you plan on using him in a sort of gadget role and really involving him in your offense, and you're valuing more having a backup quarterback because you think Carson Wentz has that sort of injury risk, then maybe the combination of those two factors elevates you from being like a fourth round pick to maybe making more sense late in the second round. I think Hurts was going to go in the third round, certainly somewhere, and probably somewhere that we would have had a whole different conversation about where he ended up just based on the fit. But one good thing about the Eagles is that you'd think it would be a good system for him to develop in terms of their ability to develop quarterbacks and maybe have some sense of a fit. Bryce Rossler wrote this article, and the title of it before the draft was "You Can Win with Jalen Hurts If You Put His Talent to Use." And it wasn't that he was trying to make the case that he should be a first round pick, but he was looking at the modern NFL with a lot of design quarterback runs and RPOs, not so different from what you see with Lamar Jackson. You can succeed with a lot of that stuff, and Oklahoma certainly did. And then his ability to get the ball down the field. I think most people, when they dug back in on his Oklahoma film this year, you saw that his deep passing was actually pretty good. So you look at those sort of things, and Bryce made a really compelling sort of list of 4 points that you need to hit if you're going to try to build an offense around Hurts. My whole thing is I just don't think he's the sort of player that is worth building the offense around like that. I don't think he is Lamar Jackson at the end of the day, but hopefully I won't be feeling like Bill Polian a year from now.
And unless Wentz gets hurt, we're not going to find out. You know, I don't know what there is to the idea of Wentz being injury prone, and therefore it's more important to have a backup for him. One of the things that came out was Adam Schefter reporting that one of the reasons they took Hurts was they felt it was more important to have a really good backup quarterback in the era of COVID-19 in case Wentz tests positive. But of course, if one player tests positive, everybody else on the team is going to get quarantined. Like, that's a whole other kettle of fish, is what do we do if the NFL comes back and then a player tests positive? But these two guys will have been studying together and sitting next to each other in that room for weeks. Like, you don't all of a sudden put in your backup quarterback. I don't think that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like if Sam Darnold had been making out with the other quarterbacks on the Jets last year.
Great. We're writing slash fiction now about the New York Jets. Fabulous.
So Hurts was a weird pick by the Eagles, but maybe it makes more sense if you kind of unpack it. A different one that needed some unpacking was Jordan Love to the Packers. You know, I talked to John Shirley, a resident Packers fan at SIS, on Friday morning, and I just asked him, like, hey, are you okay? And he was taking some time to digest it. And as you mentioned before, the draft wasn't a good one from Green Bay based on almost any evaluation. Both the Football Outsiders Index hated their draft, And in terms of their level of agreement with the Football Rookie Handbook, they came in dead last. So this was not a draft that got a lot of love from a lot of places. But John Shirley circled back, wrote about it, and wrote an article that in the Sports Info Solutions blog that said fans didn't like it, but the Packers had a plan for their offense in the 2020 draft. And I thought this was a really interesting column because he basically takes the stance of, hey, listen, I'm not trying to support this or even apologize for it, but if we take a look at this and really unpack the pieces, what they might have done here might have made sense. Now, first of all, it's maybe Jordan Love doesn't suck, like a lot of people seem to think have already written off, even though a lot of evaluators seem to think there's a lot of talent there, myself included. Obviously, I have my questions about him, but I do like the ability to develop there. But in terms of what they did outside of that pick, I think fans were bothered that they didn't draft any wide receivers with just how poor the wide receiver position had been for the Packers last year. You know, we've talked about this before. And instead, they drafted a running back, A.J. Dillon, who is really a running down only type player. Really good running the ball, has gone against all kinds of stack boxes, but not somebody who's produced in the passing game. And then Josiah DeGuara, the H-back that they drafted, you know, listed nominally as a tight end. I think John Shirley does a really interesting, makes a really interesting point. Aaron Jones and Jamal Williams are both expiring contracts at the end of this year. So getting a bell cow running back might have been something that they needed to do rather than having to overpay one of those guys next year, like we would really caution against. And then in terms of DeGuara, the idea here, you look back at LaFleur and look at what he did with the Titans and how much he wanted to use the 21 or 12 personnel. And then you look at Shanahan and the connection with LaFleur. Clearly, he's trying to do something with the offense where he can get more of that two tight end zone running game going. And when you look at the actual kind of players that are on the Packers and who's likely to come back, John does a great job of pointing out that there are actually five players that are kind of guaranteed roster spots already. When you look at Adams, Funchess, who they signed, third years, Equanimeous St. Brown, and Marquise Valdes-Scantling. Remember, they drafted both of those guys a couple of years ago. And then Alan Lazard, who played well last year. Those five spots are probably all spoken for. And then you might keep another receiver after that. But that could be Kumerow, that could be Shepard, it could be another free agent, or it could be an undrafted rookie. So even though I think there was a lot of reason to want them to take a receiver, and we can criticize the value of running backs and kind of run down players, I think if you take a step back and you understand what they're trying to do, it at least makes more sense than it looks like if you just ticket it on the surface, which is the team that has Aaron Rodgers and has him for at least two more years, drafted a quarterback and didn't draft a receiver again.
Right. I mean, we talked about this on last week's show, the one that we did on Thursday night late reviewing the draft, right? With Love, there's two issues. First is, how good is Love? Obviously was much better in 2018 than 2019. In 2019, he was like the eighth best quarterback in the Mountain West. I mean, terrible. The other is, what do you do with Aaron Rodgers' contract? And I've seen things online where you could get out of it after this year, but you're still carrying a ton of dead money, which means you're not getting really the benefit of Jordan Love being a rookie quarterback contract until 2 years from now in 2022. And then you've basically got a year to make the decision on his fifth-year option. So I think that the idea of Love as the replacement for Rodgers makes less sense from a contractual timeline point of view than it does from a how good is Love point of view. As far as taking a running back, I feel like you didn't need to take one a year. Or, you know, you could also have taken a running back next year. you didn't need to take one this year. And a running back who doesn't have passing value is a less valuable running back in the modern NFL. DeGuara is interesting because one of the things I wanted to bring up with you was the tight ends were crazy this year. Like, okay, it was considered to be a class without a lot of value. Yet a bunch of them went in the third round, and they're not the ones that anybody expected to go. And I'm not just talking about the SIS rookie handbook. I mean anybody's pre-draft, mock draft, you know, mocking the draft's value for tight ends. But like three of the top, I think, five tight ends in the rookie handbook went undrafted, right? Pinckney and Thaddeus Moss, Hunter Bryant, that's the third one. And then meanwhile, guys like the Patriots took Devin Asiasi and And then Dalton Keene. Dalton Keene was your number 21 ranked tight end who had like 200 and something yards of receiving last year. And I realize there's some people out there who feel like he could be George Kittle. Kittle didn't get a lot of usage at Iowa either. But, you know, players who get that little usage in college becoming stars, the likes of Kittle, is really, really rare. And those two guys and Aguara going before Adam Troutman is a surprise too, even though Troutman did go in the third round. So, like, the DeGuara pick is weird to me, less because of the idea that Green Bay wants to go more to tight end, maybe with him and Sternberger, and more just because all the tight ends went into weird places and in weird order this year.
Yeah, the things that I can't apologize for is that I think both of those guys were drafted around too early, at least. I don't think you needed to draft Dylan there, and I don't think you needed to draft DeGuara there. Full disclosure, the 5.8 grade on DeGuara, that's not really a draftable grade based on
what we're
doing
here. No, Dalton Keene isn't either. And you would think if the Packers and Patriots waited a round or two, those players would probably still be around. Or if not, they would have gotten players who you had rated higher, like Hunter Bryant and Jared Pinkney and Thaddeus Moss.
Yeah, so that, you know, maybe there's a vision there that they have for them. There are things, you know, always that we don't know about injuries and character stuff that might not be publicly available. But yeah, I'm with you. When you just look at it in terms of the tight ends this year were just so bad that really nobody saw them the same way. And I think you're always going to see that where you have good players, you have more consensus. When you don't have consensus, it's because the warts are there.
Yeah, and the fact that we were like, this is not a good tight end class, and then it's, let's take four tight ends in the third round. Yes, that was a need. If you're going to go more to tight end for the Packers, that's a need for the Packers. Clearly was a need for the Patriots. But yeah, I thought the way the tight ends went this year was weird. So that was just another weird thing about the Packers draft.
One thing that I wanted to point out also from that John Shirley piece, he has a great chart in there that points out that Rodgers hasn't had St. Brown and Lazard at the same time, right? St. Brown being injured all year last year, Lazard not being with the team the year before that. And he looked at the on-off splits for both of these players. So with both of those guys off the field over the last 2 years, Rodgers has been, you know, bad Rodgers. 61% completion, 6.9 yards per attempt, just 0.14 EPA per attempt. Meanwhile, with St. Brown on the field, he goes up to 64% completions, 8.2 yards per attempt, 0.29 EPA per attempt, more than double. With Lazard on the field, he's at 0.26 EPA per attempt with 16 touchdowns and no interceptions. So all of a sudden, the EPA basically doubles with just either one of these guys on the field. So maybe the thought process from internally with the Packers is that we have the guys that we need. They just all haven't been on the field together yet. And they feel better about it than, and they have reason to, potentially based on their internal evaluations. All right, last up, I want to look forward to next year. Bryce Rosler again, he wrote that Justin Fields has the tools to go number one in 2021. Obviously, everybody thinks right now that Trevor Lawrence goes number one in 2021, 100 times out of 100, looking forward at this point. But Bryce pointed out that last year was a foregone conclusion that Tua was going to be the number one pick. Burrow came kind of out of nowhere to become the guy this year. He went from being thought of as a late round pick to somebody that could be number one. And if you look at the Vegas odds right now, it's all Lawrence, Lawrence, Lawrence. Do you buy into the idea that Justin Fields could actually be the number one quarterback?
Oh, I absolutely agree. But here's the thing. I think people are so wedded to the idea of Trevor Lawrence as number one that if the college football season doesn't happen, that Trevor Lawrence is still the number one pick. I think if there is a college football season, Fields was better than Lawrence last year by almost any measure. So I think if you have another year, there's a reasonable chance Fields is better than Lawrence again, and then you've got 2 years Fields being better than Lawrence, and then absolutely Fields goes number one. Yeah, it's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, one great stat that Bryce pulled out of there. A lot of stats would show that what you said, that Trevor Lawrence played well. I think the sophomore slump narrative, he points out, was overrated. He was a very good quarterback, but Fields was really special last year. And in terms of completion percentage plus minus, which is very similar to the expected completion percentage plus minus that Next Gen Stat does, but we have this available for college football based on our charting data. And Fields was number four in the nation at a plus 10.1%. So that is based on throw depth and location. He had the fourth best mark in college football in terms of completing passes above expectation. Trevor Lawrence was 19th in that metric at plus 5.4%. But interesting, you know, you look over a lot of different things. There are a lot of reasons why you could see with the direction that the NFL is moving, why Fields with some ridiculous athleticism. Bryce talks about in here how he's been rumored to run in the 4.4s. This is a guy that has throwing ability along with physical tools and maybe less holes in his game than a Kyler Murray did because of the height. So something to keep an eye on there. I'm not sure I'm ready to put my money on Fields taking that pick.
Though Trevor Lawrence, let's give him credit also, last year, 103 carries, 563 yards, 9 touchdowns, 5.5 yards per carry. He's pretty mobile too.
Yeah, he can scoop. All right, before we get out of here, I want to talk about a couple more kind of interesting quarterback things, because we had talked about Eason, the really great arm. He ends up dropping in the draft and getting, I think, landing in a nice spot with the Colts. It could be an interesting slot for him in behind Rivers to learn from Frank Reich and potentially get the mental aspect to where it needs to be to match his physical game. I think one guy that people were keeping an eye on out of Georgia was Jake Fromm, State Farm. And Jake Fromm ends up going to the Bills and is an interesting sort of backup piece there. I think he's an ideal backup, but there are certain aspects of his game that are better than Josh Allen's game. You know, a lot of Jake Fromm's strengths are Josh Allen's weaknesses. But I wanted to come back to you because the Patriots, who I think had every opportunity to draft either of those guys as well as some others,
clearly don't believe in them.
So, is Belichick tanking?
No. Belichick, I don't believe Belichick is I mean, listen, again, I'm not in his mind. I think that the signings that they've made on defense, bringing back certain defensive pieces, suggest he doesn't think he's tanking. I think he really believes in Stidham. I think that all outside objective data based on Stidham's performance in college and the fact that he was a fourth-round pick, and fourth-round picks do not often develop into starting NFL quarterbacks, suggest that this is a bad gamble. But he clearly believes in him, and he does have in his pocket the fact that he is the one who discovered Tom Brady and made Tom Brady the starter after Bledsoe's injury and kept Tom Brady the starter after Bledsoe got healthy, and that ended up being one of the greatest decisions in the history of professional sports. So, you know, there is a little bit of an element of in Bill we trust, but I think that the odds that Stidham is going to be good are poor. And I'll tell you, the first version of the projections that I did had the Patriots' mean projection under 500 because of how bad Stidham is projected to the sort of the projecting the quarterback separate from the offense, how bad you project a fourth rounder with no experience, and then how much regression we expect from their defense, which was so dependent on turnovers last year and lost more talent in the offseason than any other defense in the last 14 years based on approximate value over replacement.
It makes sense. And it's, you know, I joked about the Patriots tanking, but I still wouldn't bet on the Bills ahead of the Patriots.
Oh, we have the Bills regressing too on defense. So, yeah.
So it's kind of amazing in that regard. I'm with you. I do think that Belichick, I don't think he thinks in terms of tanking. I think he thinks more in terms of, I think how I think, which is that sometimes you have to think about current assets versus future assets and make decisions that are appropriate. And I think he's realizing that right now, coming off of the Brady contract and kind of having a little bit of a reset, I think what he is trying to do is what you're saying, kind of make sure he locks down the right pieces on defense. The secondary stays right, and he has that set. That's what he really cares about. And then build the team, and then whether it's this quarterback that he can be on the rookie deal or it's next year being able to bring somebody in that he can develop, I think that the vision is there for the team, and it's Belichick.
There's certainly a possibility also that part of his mindset here is we can't teach our offense to a free agent quarterback because there won't be OTAs. That might be part of his thought process, whereas Hoyer is coming back to the offense, knows it. Stidham's been in the offense for a year, so he's already had the experience in it.
Worst case scenario, roll with Hoyer. I mean, it's really not like, look, you can't, this could be a playoff team with Brian Hoyer.
If the
right?
defense doesn't regress as much as I'm expecting it to be. Honestly, based on, you know, regression, the Bills defense is likely to regress also. They don't have a really good quarterback either. The Patriots could start Brian Hoyer and their defense could regress, and they could still win the division at 8-8. Like, I would not be surprised if next year's division champion in the AFC East is 8-8.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I just hope we play the season so we can find out.
Yeah, I also would not be surprised if next year's division champion in the AFC East is 6-6.
Ugh, I don't even want to think about that.
It's funny because we're going back and doing all this database stuff at Football Outsiders, and I have to keep explaining about 1987 and how, oh God, 1987 is 12 games, but it's also 16 games. And some places it's 12 games, you know, because we don't count the strike games. And oh, I don't want to have to do that with 2022.
It's so ridiculous to think about that they had strike games and non-strike games in the same season. And that's how they tried to, what a different time that must have been.
Can you imagine them trying to get away with that now? Can you imagine what the reaction would be like, ESPN and Twitter and whatever, if they tried to bring in strike breaker players, essentially brought in the XFL rosters to play in the NFL now? Like, that would be crazy balls.
Yeah, it would be super crazy. And that, you know, I'm really worried about college football. I think it's looking good for the NFL, fans or no fans in the stands. It seems like we're hopefully trending towards finding a way. College football, it's a lot more difficult. Noticing that the NCAA keeps trying to create, they're more and more open to finding ways for players to make money now that it seems like the entire season might not get canceled because the optics of trying to play a football season so that you can make money while students aren't actually in classes on campus is too much. I think that has a whole lot to do with it.
The problem is, I mean, there's so many problems. And I just posted an extra point on Football Outsiders with a link to a long article about all of this. But one of the problems is that, unlike in the NFL, it's all about the TV money. In college, like, how do you have the money to make the team go? Like, the TV contracts may work for the SEC and for Notre Dame, but the TV contract is not going to bring in enough money for North Texas and Central Michigan to play a season, let alone Division I AA or Division II.
Well, I think that's part of it. The other thing is, you know, because people have made that point, and I heard somebody said that it was like 75% gate money, which sounded like a ridiculous number to me, and I've heard some questions. But when I look at ESPN and the amount of stake that they have in this and having those games get played, I think that's a really major player in addition to the schools and the NCAA. I don't think anybody's as incentivized as ESPN to get these games actually on TV.
And Fox and CBS, frankly. CBS, you know, I mean, that SEC game on Saturday makes them a lot of money.
No doubt about it. All right. We will sign off and get out of here. And of course, we are recruiting now at Sports Info Solutions for 2020 football video scouts. So we are anticipating that season that we were just talking about will go on without a hitch. And if you are interested in applying, you can head to the career section of our website, sportsinfosolutions.com. And of course, the Football Rookie Handbook is also still available. You can get it on activesports.com. You can get it on Amazon if you're interested in reading more about any of the players that your team just picked. For my co-host, Aaron Schatz, our producer, Justin Stein, I'm Matt Manicharian, and thank you for joining us for the latest episode of the Off the Charts Football Podcast.